Welcome to the Evo India podcast. Today on the podcast, we are talking about the Maruti 800. It's 40 years of the 800. December of 1983, that's when the first Maruti 800 was delivered. And we're talking about 40 years of not just the Maruti 800, but what Maruti Suzuki has done to the automotive industry in India. In the studio, we have with us Adil Jal Darukhanawala, editor-at-large at Evo India and a noted automotive historian. Adil's going to talk about his experiences with the 800, the various generations of the 800, continuing on with the Alto. So the 800, the Zen, the Alto, even the A-Star, the Celerio, all of that are part of that same lineage, one of the best-selling lineages in the world and obviously the best-selling in the country. So welcome to the Evo India podcast. Adil, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
What did the automotive industry look like pre-Maruti?
Disjointed, nothing on terms of quality, always a seller's market, socialist India, rationed stuff, everything. And understand one more thing, there was a Maruti which was supposed to be made in 1970. Mm-hmm. That was Sanjay Gandhi's Maruti. One of the biggest scams which ever erupted in independent India.
Can you elaborate on that? I've heard a lot about it. What was the scam?
The scam was the Congress party needed money. The banks refused to give them. So it was actually being started around about 67, 68. Or let's go even further. The government of India in the 50s, after the tariff commission came in and told the established who were assemblers like Ford, General Motors, Chrysler, and the Studebaker Corporation, they all were doing that in India with local partners. They said, you either localize or you shut shop, because it was a laudable thought. The country needed it that way. So you suddenly ended up only with Premier Automobiles having a collaboration with Fiat. Hindustan Motors, who had a collaboration with the Nuffield organization, which made the Morris. And you also had Standard Motors, which had a collaboration with Standard Triumph of England. And you had the Mahindras with Willys from the US. All the rest went out. So around that time, 1957, the talk about an Indian cheap people's car started gathering strength. And the government said, okay, please let us know what can be possible. So a lot of people jumped into the fray. Everyone, Tata's included, Hindustan Motors included, Fiat, even specialists like Force Motors. Then there were individuals who came in. So a lot of guys jumped into that thing. But the government knew that it was not going to do anything. So it was mostly forgotten till the time the Congress party in the 60s needed money. And Sanjay Gandhi was trying to make a so-called people's car. It was perceived in inverted commas that he was an engineer, which obviously he was not. He was an enthusiast who knew that cars could be a sort of a ticket to something big and all that. So they made grandiose plans and they advertised massively for dealers. And in the 60s, please understand the value of the rupee then and whatnot, they collected lakhs and lakhs of rupees from would-be dealers. And all the dealers thought suddenly small car, 20,000 rupees or 16,000 rupees, at that time, I think it was 12,000 rupees, because the premier was around that price. So tons of money came, but there was hardly any action in that big shed which they had made. I think they ended up doing some 27, 28 units of that car, which were a copy of a East European two-stroke engine car.
If I'm not mistaken, it was rear-engined also.
Yes, it was rear-engined. Yes, so it was a straight copy. They could not make those twin cylinders fire in unison to do that. So if you read in my Java book, at one time, Sanjay Gandhi asked Farooq Irani to send his two Java experts from Mysore to help sort out the two-stroke thing. Mm-hmm. when they went there, they saw that, they knew it could be done, but overall the fundamentals were very weak. And they came back saying that it's better to re-engineer, to redesign a whole car than to try to adapt that what they had got. So what happened is they collected the money and that thing failed. There was no car, nothing came out. And a lot of things, the Congress was saved because the 71 war happened. Just before that, the Congress then nationalized the banks as well. They need, because the banks were not willing to give the money to the Maruti proposal at that time. So there were too much politics which was there. And so the government stepped in and nationalized that thing. Sort of a bailout without anything. So they, after 75, after the emergency and whatnot and all that, then the government said, no, we have to do something. Because then they said, started searching for suitors to make Maruti Udyog the small car hub for the country. And to the detriment of all the rest of the manufacturers then, whatever they were. So Ford, Renault, Daihatsu, so a lot of people were involved, even Fiat and whatnot. But they didn't have the right approach to India, because India was very complex, it still is very complex right now also. And at a lucky break on a flight, some Suzuki executive saw a thing in a magazine and they moved rather quickly. The key thing in this industry is you need to be fleet-footed. I think that was the luckiest fleet-footed move made by Suzuki in its entire history. Again, what do you call, stick my neck out and say that thing. Because as you can see, 75% of Suzuki's profits globally come from India. So, end of discussion on that front.
So, that was pre-Maruti.
Yes.
Now, the story that you talked about, Suzuki executive on an Indian Airlines flight, he saw the story in India Today, and then he spoke to his big bosses in Japan, they sent a fax. Who were the guys in India who were heading this project? Because you had to have some good people running it, right?
No, so at that time, Mr. Krishnamurthy, who was the chairman of the Steel Authority of India, who was Mrs. Gandhi's right-hand man and a very good bureaucrat, a technocrat. So he was there in that sort of sense. But again, there was no designation to Maruti Udyog was there as an entity by the government. Still nothing was. So a bunch of bureaucrats started doing this thing. They were, once they knew that Suzuki was serious, because amongst the others, Volkswagen and Renault and whatnot, even Ford, they were hesitant about committing financially to the joint venture. Here was a thing for Suzuki to really get into a populous country, because one day or the other knew this country would, with this inclusive market, would really mushroom. So that foresight which Suzuki showed then was massive, which none of the others were willing to show. So when this happened, and at that time, when the government said, yes, let's get cracking. So the first port of call from Indira Gandhi's side was to get the expertise of the Tatas on board. So the telco board was sounded out. Sumant Mulgaonkar, who was the managing director, and he said yes. So Sumant Mulgaonkar, with a group of handpicked executives from telco, helped set up the structure of the company to a certain extent then. And at that point in time, there were still, what you call, the 73, you had the first fuel crisis. So in that sort of sense, they knew that we needed to have road transport be more efficient, etc. So Mulgaonkar and gang said, let us, what you call, ask Maruti Udyog to make state-of-the-art commercial vehicles there. So, but they still, the Congress government said, no, let's make cars. But they still established a structure. And once they did that and they found Suzuki was coming in, so they gracefully exited. Krishnamurthy really set into motion a lot of things. So he handpicked also many people. Bhargava came in, R.C. Bhargava. These two were the real cornerstones of the first prong of executives which plotted the Maruti advent into India.
And these bureaucrats had zero car making experience, obviously, because India did not have much.
Nothing. But the question, they had one thing though, but in their favor. The government was firmly backing them. Mm. The government never backed any private industry. So it shows, it's a, what do you call, example to everyone. If you are really on the government side, the government likes you, come what may, it will not only help you get everything done, but it will go out of its way to see that you are a success.
So in those days, and this is what I've read, that there used to be red tape everywhere. Oh. But for Maruti, there was the red carpet that was rolled out.
I'll tell you one thing. I bought my first car on 5th of December, 1986. It was a Maruti van, the high roof van. And in the month of about April 2, 1987, in the heat, the car refused. The fuel filters and the fuel pumps were just not up to the task. So I remember there was cars were stopping. They were not working at all. Maruti ordered two jumbo jet loads of fuel pumps from Japan with the revised diaphragms and whatnot to cope with the heat and whatnot. They came in a matter of days. This never has happened across with any other car maker. Mm. So yes, the red, and again, no questions asked. It was just about it.
So talking about the red carpet that it was rolled out for them, there were a lot of hurdles for other manufacturers. There were even quotas put in place that you couldn't make more than X number of cars. What was different for Maruti?
Once the thing happened that they found out that, see, there was, the government had to, what do you call, first give, deliver a product which worked. Mm-hmm. On the product front, there was no issue, which was a mighty big turnaround from the Sanjay Gandhi time. Mm. So that was important. Second thing, the product, actually speaking, denoted quality, which the ambassador of the Fiat just didn't have. Mm. Or they weren't allowed to have, because not just... What important was, you have to understand one thing, the government never gave foreign exchange, never allowed foreign exchange to be given to these other companies to import machine tools. And you need good machine tools and other manufacturing stuff for the final output to be really top-notch. Mm-hmm. They were still battling with 1940s, 1950s equipment. Maruti got state-of-the-art manufacturing equipment. Mm-hmm. That was, which not many people understand. Mm. They only saw the product. Mm. But to make a good product, you need the good manufacturing processes and equipment and whatnot. So there was a sea change. The good thing about it was Maruti opened the eyes of how to make a car, how to manage people. And right from day one, they were very clear that they wanted to make 100,000 cars per annum. Whereas at that point in time, the entire produce from the 3-4 manufacturers, not even 50 or 60,000 units per annum. That was, so thinking big was very important. They knew that the pricing at that time that said about 43, 44,000 rupees at startup for the car. And everyone had laughed across over there. But the key thing was that you didn't have to only look at the price point at which the car was sold, but how the car maintained its value over the long term. Mm. That was an eye-opener.
Just for a sense of perspective, 43,000, 45,000, in those days, how much was an equivalent Padmini or an Ambassador? Was it cheaper? Was it more expensive?
It was thereabouts.
So it wasn't much cheaper than a Padmini
no,
or
it
an
was
Ambassador?
No, it was not. So that's why the people say, oh, this is small, Ambassador is big.
So why was the 800 the people's car? We already had cars at the same price.
Yeah.
So what was it that, why was it the people's car?
Because the government was making it. And if you care to see about it, look at all the people's cars in the world. Volkswagen looked at it from Adolf Hitler's perspective. During Benito Mussolini's thing, the Fiat 500 Topolino came in. around the same time the 2CV Citroën was developed in France. Around the same time, all these people's cars started coming in. And like it or not, even Renault, the Citroën and whatnot, they still had a lot of government backing even in France. So I think...
So that's why it was the people's car.
That's why, right? That's why I think right now.
So in terms of manufacturing, like you said, no, they were allowed to import state-of-the-art components. But I also believe that the government gave them a very strict timeline in which to launch the first car to coincide with Sanjay Gandhi's birthday.
Yeah, that could be a thing. But the question is, like I said, when you remove red tape... And then everything, you are seeing things in India now over the last about 15, 16 years, that if there's a will, the way is automatically there. And right now, what we are seeing is we are not seeing it as a largesse only to one or the other. Today, we are allowing anyone who's got the vision they want to do, they get their opportunity. There, the opportunity was only given to Maruti. Mm-hmm. It was not given, the others were denied.
So, obviously, it received great response. The SS80, that was the first Maruti 800, the first generation of the Maruti 800. But that was a car that was being discontinued in Japan, which was sent to India. And that was the car that was supposed to be localized and completely manufactured in India. But R.C. Bhargava and Mr. Krishnamurthy, they put their foot down on that.
Absolutely.
Talk us through that.
Yeah, that's the right thing. Because, again, the answer to this was already there, what you mentioned, to coincide with the timeline. So many kits of that edgy 800 came here, SS80. And it was a revelation. It was smooth. It was... The dynamics were awesome. Of course, you had to reevaluate how you got in and out of the car from the Marutis, from the Padminis and the Ambassadors. But yes, and like I said, the quality blew everyone away. And the performance and the fuel efficiency. Most important was fuel efficiency.
It was what? At least double the Ambassadors and Padminis?
Not double, but at least 50% more than...
At least.
So, and consistent. Mm-hmm. So there was no question of wishy-washy things across it. So thankful. It was constant across over there.
I think in terms of the quality, you know, just so that the younger listeners and viewers can understand how important the step up in quality was. The Ambassadors, the wipers would barely work. The headlamps, if they worked, it was great. They are working. If you drive from, say...
What are the horns?
The horns, right? If you drive from Bangalore to Pune and if you reached without breaking down, that
it
used
was
to be
a revelation.
Big deal.
It was a big, really
the
big
Ambassadors
deal.
Used to always carry spare fan belts, spare cables, bulbs, everything. You always had spares and you always had a proper toolkit in the car to effect roadside repairs if you needed to. With the Maruti, you didn't need anything.
It was sorted out from day one. It was a sorted out product. Again... let's not be unfair to the other manufacturers. And the government denied them a lot of manufacturing. But if you have to see another area in which the Indian automotive industry worked, take the case of Telco. They were also denied a lot of things, but they developed their own machine tools. So they had the vision, they had the drive, they had the others in the typical Birla, Doshi way and whatnot. They say, ek baar dekhenge, kabhi kuch ho gaya to ho gaya. That sort of, and that also determined the morass they found themselves in, you know. And suddenly a new, spanking new take on an automobile comes in. They were floundering. They themselves were not able to contemplate. And then when a lot of representatives went to the government saying that you can't do this to existing manufacturers. So what happens? They were allowed to go. So what they did, they went again the cheap, easy way. Buy discarded models from A manufacturer, buy engines and transmissions from B manufacturer and try to put it all together. That's what you saw. The Contessa came in, the 118NE came in. So again... It was bits and pieces made with that approach and they were charging top money anyway. Mm-hmm. So the difference in approach, Maruti's approach was the way, logical way to do a great car.
Was there a lot of transparency in the way that Maruti interacted with their customers? I believe when the first lot of bookings came in, that was the first time a computerized setup was introduced where people were picked up by random lots.
True.
You had to go to the State Bank of India and book the car or get a DD or something like that.
But the thing is that this had already happened earlier with Bajaj Auto when the M50 came in. I know that you had to buy that form, and that form was costing 100 rupees. And they ran out of forms on the first day. Mm-hmm. And they were in. So Maruti knew that this is a sort of thing, and Bajaj Auto was ill-prepared because everything was manually done. Mm. So they incepted so many things, so many good things that happened. It happened always, like I said, Volkswagen started off with the dictator. Mm-hmm. And look where it's become right now. There are parallels which can be drawn. I'm not saying anything to incur, but there was a sort of a single-minded dedication from the government to make Maruti a success.
So we'll talk about the cars and the evolution of the cars, but we must talk about the culture that Maruti incorporated in a country that was mired in red tape, in Babuism, all of
Sab
that.
Sab chalta hai.
Chalta hai.
Kuch bhi chalta hai. They dispelled that massively. First,
How did that happen? Because they were run by Babus.
They were run by Babus, but the Japanese told them what to do. Mm. And I think an edict was there, please listen to the Japanese. They know what they are doing. Mm-hmm. So I think that was a big thing for both of them to learn and listen. The Japanese could not run roughshod over certain Indian sensibilities. And the Indians couldn't say, we'll look, hold on doggedly to what we perceive to be right without you. So there was a lot of give and take there. But they realized they came into a certain median in the thing that, yes, let's absorb the good points from both cultures. Mm-hmm. And I think that, and they absorbed it well and they delivered it as well. And you could see that, you know.
Mm. There are stories about how the office was set up at the Maruti headquarters. Everybody, other companies in India had cubicles and those partitions.
An
open culture. It was a full open culture.
Flat open culture.
Everybody had to clean their own desks.
Yes.
There was all of that, different layers, all of those were knocked out. And that brought in a lot of transparency in the way they function also.
It had to be, you know, it had, because there's no point in hiding something from anyone when the obvious thing across over there, if you do hide, that means there's something wrong. So you just dispel that notion completely, you know.
So we talked briefly about the SS80, but the more important car in the Indian perspective is the SB308, the upgrade on the SS80. How big a change was that compared to the SS80?
Oh, it was massive. When the SS80 was there until 85, 83 December, let's not take 83 as a thing. One whole year, 84, and a certain portion of 1985. That was where the kits were. The new, curvier, slightly rounded edges thing, and slightly larger visually, that car came in. It was not just about a body change. It was also completely new engine change. The engine from the SS80 and this, I think, didn't what you call match at all. You, apart from bore and stroke, maybe, everything else was different. Crank, pistons, this, that, the induction system. Everything was. So it was a ground-up new design, and that is really wonderful. And it was probably one big step up. So by the time Premier got its 118 in the Contessa Sunday, they had to contend with not just the new 800, but you also had the van and you also had the Gypsy. So these three came in rapid succession. So suddenly, from a one-model company, it became a three-model company.
And that was always part of the plan.
It was always part of the plan. So the question is, why were the others not doing it?
Mm. So the SB308, it had more space, it had better ride comfort, easier to get in and out of.
Yeah.
A boot that actually opened like a hatch, not just the glass that was opening. And they started to localize heavily in India.
It was. They needed profits to do. One of the questions, this localized bit, is another untold story which not everyone is only mired in production. So if you have to arrest cost from just going out of the window, because even the government realized that it could not keep an open door policy to as many things coming from Japan, they had to localize. And the localization program, which was allowed to happen, was massive because Suzuki got its component guys from overseas and they did joint ventures with component guys here. So those, and Suzuki, Maruti Suzuki, I think, oversaw that entire effort, which was massive, and it helped spawn, till that time, the best localized company in India was Telco, because their ancillary development department, and in fact, their ADD chief was the guy who went there and set up everything for Maruti. So they had the best. But again, at that time, the government was not allowing any Forex to go or any JVs to happen like that. Maruti coming in was a blessing in disguise. These sort of things which happen, and today, India's component industry is one of the world's biggest automotive component industries, which not many people, the government has to realize the amount of money which it earns through the component makers is much more than the OEMs.
The SB308, the car, the van, and the Gypsy, what did they have in common?
The 800 and the van had some commonality as far as the engines were concerned. Maybe the size of the wheels, the van and the thing. Gypsy was completely different animal. It was part of the old Jimny, but the shorter wheelbase. So they extended the wheelbase for India. They needed that and also made it a wider track by and large. But that was it. So it was a very capable go anywhere vehicle. It was not going to do any great shakes in any other aspect, but to go in tough terrain and get you to there and back. So that's it was not a vehicle which would be the first choice thing of anyone. But all of a sudden, what happened was in the Himalayan rally from 85 or 86 onwards, the Gypsy started making its mark. And Maruti had given two Gypsies to the Army Adventure Foundation. And they performed very well. And so Maruti got the army guys to be the fulcrum of their motorsport effort, so to speak. And Colonel Sekhon and Chauhan, they were the topmost purveyors of the rallying art with the Gypsy. They went on to win the national award, I think, twice or thrice. And by that time, the other motorsport fraternity guys had also cottoned on to that. Team MRF also got into the act. Nikhil Taneja beat the Chauhans and whatnot in one of the Himal. The Gypsy became a real cornerstone for our small, minuscule motorsport fraternity.
So, we'll talk about motorsport, but the reason I was asking you that is today when a manufacturer launches a car in India, for instance, they have a hatchback, they have a sedan, they have a van, they have all like five different variants on the same platform. But here I was coming from that Suzuki didn't have like a common platform that they were sharing between these three cars. So it was not like there was a lot of cost saving in making three cars instead of one car. The Gypsy had nothing in common.
Shirish, what they did, you know, keep the Gypsy apart, but look at the van and the 800. There was also a plan to get the Suzuki Carry, the pickup version of the van, which has only come in now, last 10 years ago or something. But they never had anything else. And they had a very finely developed plan. Let's offer the car and the van at a certain price point. So there's a step up or step down was easy for anyone. I think that was very vital to how Maruti played the positioning game.
Why did you buy the van and not the car?
Because the waiting list for the car. The van I could get in 3 months.
And the car was how long?
Car was about 18 months.
18 months?
18 months.
So,
and I needed a car. Like when you have the money, you want the car as of yesterday. You have the money today, but you want the car as of yesterday.
So we were very patient in those days. So let's come back to motorsport.
Yeah.
Was the 800 raced, rallied?
Yeah, it was. It was raced at Cholavaram and at Juhu. I know guys like Jay Anand. Jay Anand was a master with the 800. And we have got photographs of him on three wheels, turning into a corner, lifting the outside wheel when he was doing that. Farhad Bhatina drove, Kamlesh Patel drove these cars. Karivardhan had made some things across over there. And at Juhu, at Cholavaram, at Barrackpore, these cars were, and they took the fight to the Fiats mm-hmm. in the open saloon car races and whatnot.
And they won?
Yeah, they won. Mm-hmm. They won. So, and then they had a, what do you call, competition from the Dolphin, which came in. The Dolphins were tuned way better and whatnot. They were rear wheel drive mm-hmm. and all that. So, there was a good, what do you call, matchup between them. But because Dolphin, again, that bits and pieces approach, attitudes were different. The Sipanis were really not known for their acumen in doing everything upright and whatnot. So that thing failed over there. But the Marutis did that. And in rally, the 800 was also rallied, I think, 3-4 times in the Himalayan rally. And I used to see the car. Adil Nargolwala used to drive one. He finished that rally across over there. But the car was beat up completely at the end of the rally. Means it was a nervous wreck. It was tough. It was a toughie, but it didn't have the punch when it mattered across over there. But that's okay. So that was a different thing. But the Gypsies really came into their own. And the Gypsies sounded the death knell for the premier Padminis in Indian rallying. Mm-hmm. That was it.
Yeah, and of course, after that came the S team and all
yes,
that. We're not going to dive into that because the next car that Maruti launched in India was the Zen.
Yes.
And the 800...
Early 90s.
The 800 and the Zen ran parallelly. It was not like the Zen replaced the 800.
No.
Whereas it should have.
It should have.
Because but internationally, then, it was...
But again, it was again, it's a very well thought of thing, strategy, which so many other manufacturers have picked up. Because they could price the Zen and make more money with trying to distinguish it as a larger car. And I think the difference between the two was almost 80,000-90,000 rupees. And 80,000-90,000 rupees is a big thing.
So I was a kid reading automotive magazines, and that was the first time I heard this term, read this term, yuppies.
Yuppie.
That the Zen was the yuppie car.
I remember that.
What is a yuppie?
I think a more enlightened puppy. but it was right because I remember there was also a big sea change in attitudes when the Maruti first came in the 800. The first 800 came in two models, a standard model and a deluxe model. The deluxe model had air conditioning, leatherette seats, wonderful. But again, one glaring omission as always, which even Mr. Bhargava never bothered about, was a rear view mirror on the left-hand door. Mm-hmm. It never came in. But and I remember one of my very close colleagues who used to work in Maruti Udyog then, he said that when the Japanese came across over and they had got that thing and they had an evaluation session as what to offer. So they started, okay, this not needed for India, that's not needed for India. So the leatherette seats and the deluxe version for the first thing was only there till 85. After that, the deluxe version, they had an AC and they had fabric seats, which was wonderful. I don't think that we needed leatherette seats in a car like that, which in any way that AC was perfunctory. It hard because so much of glass area in the car and that it used to with our weather and all that. But I saw one thing, the big social change which happened. You had a Maruti 800, owning a Maruti 800 because again, like with the lottery system and whatnot, I'd see it in Pune on Jangli Maharaj Road, one old gent sitting behind in a chauffeur-driven Maruti. Even a Mercedes-Benz at that time didn't have that magic as the Maruti 800 has.
And it democratized everything.
Oh, yes.
Everybody bought a Maruti 800. It wasn't like only people who could afford and barely afford a car bought it. Everybody bought it, right?
The latent desire of anyone anywhere in the world is to own a car after their house and whatnot. Indians are no different. We were denied. Again, like I said, that socialism said no. That's not good for you. Everything was banished. Everyone wanted to be seen and driving a car. And here they wanted to be then when you've got the option of buy the best across over there. And the Maruti 800 was the best, any which way.
But I want to put another question to you in terms of the 800 and the Zen selling side by side. The Zen was the replacement to whatever was being sold in Japan. It was not like the old 800 was sold along with the Zen. Why were Indians denied that opportunity to now discard the 800, move up in life, and now the Zen becomes your people's car?
I was also tell you one, this is a very good point. Around the time when the Zen came in, there was certain sort of a impasse between the government and Suzuki. And at that point in time, Suzuki was hesitant to give the Zen. And there were a lot of things which happened at that time. And the government said, okay, let's go and find out what we... So Maruti Udyog, that was the name of the company. So not Maruti Udyog commissioned Porsche Engineering to devise a family of engines for future Marutis.
Really?
Yeah. So, okay. And those engines in modular engines from 800cc, 1000cc, 1200cc, four cylinders, and completely modern in every aspect. They were shown at Auto Expo. At that time, when that thing happened, Suzuki got the message loud and clear. So even though the government had paid for that entire thing, that project was never taken on for production ever.
So these engines were commissioned, prototypes were made.
Prototypes made, engineering drawings, the process, everything was done. The engines were shown at Auto Expo.
And those would go into what cars?
All new Marutis.
Okay.
So when that thing happened, Suzuki said, okay, then the Zen suddenly came in.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to understand that fact of life also. So I don't...
So if the government had not done this, and we always say that the government is lethargic and slow and they don't care about us. But if the
Maruti
government hadn't done
favorite
it...
Son, nah.
Yeah, but if the government hadn't done it,
yeah,
we would still be saddled with 800.
Yes.
Maruti
yes.
did not... Yes. Suzuki did not want to give us yes. upgraded cars.
No, so at that time they thought... It was too early for India, so to speak.
Wow.
So there are so many stories behind the things. And so India did not get a Porsche. one more thing across. This is the first time we had a car in India with a 5-speed gearbox. Mm. The Zen came with a 5-speed gearbox. And I remember I had a Zen with me. I'd bought a Zen. So I'd gone for service. So there was one guy, someone else had come there for. He said, I'm not getting the fuel efficiency and whatnot. So they say, how do you drive? My charo gear chala. They said, what was fifth? That guy said, I didn't know it had a fifth gear. So the consumer was also not, what do you call, open across over there to learn what was it and all that. He was driving the streams, notions of what he used to drive earlier, you know.
The Zen was also like a luxury car, right? It was, if I'm not mistaken, the first car to come standard with all variants with an air conditioner.
Yes.
You know, so that, in terms of the offering to the public, was a big step up.
Oh, no. When you drove the car, you felt it that it was a different animal.
An all-new engine?
Yes, absolutely.
That all-aluminum yes. engine?
So it was, dynamically, it was so good. It was brilliant. Actually, I was after Maruti to make a 3-door version of this car because they were making it here and exporting it. So after God knows how long, they made that carbon and steel versions, 1,000 of each or something. But they did not do the right thing by them. They should have got the cars kitted out inside as well to denote performance, sportiness. They only did a 3-door version. So Maruti was also evolving. I don't think the bean counters there, and a lot of those product managers were scared about their jobs and KRAs and whatnot. So sometimes it doesn't behove anyone to work in such fear. You have to, what you call, try to do that. So, but the 3-door Zen could have been a game changer.
They also made a monstrosity on the Zen.
Oh,
the
that
Zen
was
classic.
This is exactly what I say. You do that, but you don't do the obvious. So it's not that Maruti cannot make mistakes. Maruti has made ample mistakes.
Mm. So we had all those variants of the Zen. Obviously, after that, we had the Esteem. You know,
no, but we after the thing, we also got the Alto back
exactly.
in a new form.
Yeah.
You know?
So that's what I was coming to. Mm. When we got the Alto, which was around the 2000s?
2000. 2000,
right? The 800 was in production for nearly 15,
a decade,
20,
yes.
Right? A long time. But even the Alto never replaced the 800. The 800 continued. We had the Zen and we had the Alto. So we had, at one point in time, three generations of the same car.
Not just sold. That. And they were milking it well. They were the product guys and the the people who were making the costings and the pricing. They were really, that made it into fine art. Mm. And actually speaking afterwards, you saw with Skoda also.
Mm-hmm.
the Octavia came in, then the new Octavia came in, both survived. So a lot of people, same thing with Tata Motors, the Indica came in, the
Vista came in.
Yeah. So a lot of things happened. So people learned from each other. Inspiration is a great thing. And but Maruti, even today, if you see how the Alto, the Wagonar, the Celerio, etc., there are versions available for any need at every 20,000-30,000 rupee step up stone and whatnot. I think that's a fantastic thing, and Maruti makes its presence felt on this front.
Yeah. So the Alto, again, it was supposed to be the replacement of the Zen. The Alto was obviously much bigger, better in terms of ride comfort, because by then Maruti knew the weaknesses of the current range. They needed better performance, fuel efficiency. Everything was in the Alto. Talk us through the car, because initially it never really got the kind of response that maybe Maruti expected.
What you say is very true, and understand that car also came in with a 1000cc engine as well. So they offered it with two engines, the 800 and the 1000. And the price point, everyone thought, for the new car was a bit steeper than what the 800 it replaced had. So that was very, though Maruti didn't want to make a blunder by closing this car and getting the new one. So they let both go along. But they knew. And that is where, if you remember what we did for the Alto with the 24-hour run at, that was there done specifically to give a big boost to the Alto by saying small car winning big battles. And when we did that, and you plot the graph after that, the Alto sales shot up massively.
Yeah, it took some time, but then obviously it became the best-selling car in the country. Yes. And it stood there for how many years?
Oh, 10 years? 10 years, 12 years.
Unchallenged.
Yes, unchallenged.
The best-selling car in the country. And that was when the 800 was still around. So then people had caught on to the fact that the 800 was old.
Correct.
And the Alto was a big step up. But the Alto was always a... it was never positioned as something that was desirable. It was always a workhorse.
It's functional.
Right?
It's functional, utility... basic people mover, ultra reliable, means it's the girl next door whom you don't give really too much credit for. Don't you take it for granted that she will deliver. The car was solid. It was there, that ultimate reliability, etc. So if you care to think about it, how did Maruti replace that? Then with the K9 engine, that further increased the lifespan of the Alto. The new K9 engine really helped massively.
So the Alto, what were the improvements or even the changes that were done for India? The engine was for India, right?
For India. Because by that time, everywhere else in the world where Suzuki was, Hungary to speak, China to a certain extent and whatnot, they had already moved on to the Zen class of car. They never, what you call, stood. The A-Star which came in was an Alto, made in India and sold as an Alto globally. And it worked very well in Europe for some time. But Europe also was becoming very strong and harsh on crash test safety and whatnot. And those cars were not. And to add the sort of high tensile steel and whatnot made a mockery of the pricing process. So if you, so there were so many stories about Maruti's made in India for Europe, structurally different than structurally for what we got
was
here.
Was it a fact?
There was a lot of hearsay. And I think some of the magazines told the right curb weight of the car, which was definitely higher than what was the curb weight of the car here.
Okay. So there was actually truth to the claim that many people were saying that the cars that were exported were different from the cars that were sold to India.
Of course.
India.
You know, many, very many ways they were different. You also had left-hand door mirrors as well.
Okay.
And you also had day and night inside rear-view mirrors and whatnot. Actually speaking, for small cars which are there, you needed these more than you needed in the big cars. So this is something which really used to puzzle me massively. Why can't Maruti do the simple things like these, you know, on safety aspect?
Let's talk about R&D and what sort of R&D Maruti Udyog had at the start. And then when did their entire Indian engineering, Indian styling actually start to take place?
Shirish, this has to be seen in terms of how much does it cost to do R&D here and in Japan? And here you have a pool of highly talented Indian engineers at, say, one-third the price you need to get to pay them vis-a-vis people in Japan or Europe. It was sheer economics. And first they thought, Suzuki thought that it's not right to, what you call, do that in India. But then they realized that intrinsically they were wedded to Maruti Udyog. Come what may, Maruti Udyog would never go to another manufacturer. Slowly that thought process changed in their minds as well. The JVs with the component makers helped massively. And then they realized, they started grudgingly putting forward a design department in India. And if you think about it, when we were at Overdrive, we had done a design competition. Yes. And that design competition was won by Ajay Saran Sharma, who was a Maruti designer then. Mm. We had set cars for 2020 and his thing. And today, and Ajay Saran Sharma is one of those guys, unsung heroes, who did so much great work with Pratap Bose for Tata Motors, and now he's with Mahindra and Mahindra. So if you care to, these sort of guys were first given their grounding at that design department. Similarly, they started, look at Raman San in Maruti. He is one of those engineers, Ivy Rao. They are stalwarts. So these guys got the thing that they could deliver and mastermind R&D programs here in India. So they made that thing. And today, if you see their R&D setup, which is there in Haryana, I believe, Rohtak, it's world class.
Yeah, yeah. They have a bigger test track, their own captive yes. test track than even what Mahindra has.
Yes, yes.
At the MSPD.
But that is commitment. Yes. That is, it took them a long time to do it.
So what were the first projects that were undertaken by the Indian R&D on the Marutis that we bought here?
I think the first thing they did was getting that diesel Peugeot engine and putting it in the STM and in that Zen. Those were the things which happened first. But after that, they engineered the Swift diesel.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an awesome car.
Yes.
And
yeah, and from there, there's no looking back.
There's
now
no looking
back.
Exactly.
Cars are done here.
Yes, absolutely. So, and it needed, because there's no better proving ground for any car anywhere in the world than in India, you know.
So, this brings me to the other question, and you spoke about it briefly, about Maruti and Suzuki's relationship with the government. When the company started off, what was the government's take?
They were both individual 26% holders.
And then slowly, Suzuki bought over the government.
No, not stake. I think they were 50-50. Not, and slowly, you know, when you must realize one thing, R.C. Bhargava ran the ship for a long time. Then there was a breakdown and an impasse in government thing. So R.S.S.L.N. Bhaskarudu, who was the head of manufacturing, became the managing director. There was a term of his at that time. And at that time, relations between Maruti and Suzuki were really touch and go at that time. But they still held on to each other. And then, honestly, the biggest jump which Maruti made, with all due respects to Mr. Bhargava, was Jagdish Khattar. Mm-hmm. Let's not forget that man. He had single-handedly changed the fortunes of the Indian tea board globally. And Indian tea, which is known the world over, was thanks to Jagdish. So he was a bureaucrat. He came with no preconceived notions. He was very consumer-centric, market-oriented, etc. And he really opened a lot of minds within the company and outside. So, and I think a lot of credit has to, he's not got that much credit in the present day and age, but he did that. He did
like
that.
What? You want to elaborate on the stuff? Right? You must have interacted with Khattar a lot, right?
Yes. Khattar was always Bhargava's understudy when he was there. And the Swift, when it happened, so I remember the Swift, and we had this drive in Lonavala. It was there in Bombay. And they said, with Maruti's great tradition of diesel, I said, this is your first diesel. What? So he said, okay, you got. He was very fair, sporting. He could take criticism. Earlier criticism was not welcomed by many. Mm-hmm. It was a typical Indian way of life. But the thing is that this happened, he was eager to listen. He also told us very many things. Let's not forget one more thing, Shirish. There was one contraption known as the Zen Estilo.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A lot of us praised it, but it was a massive failure for Parvati. So Khattar told me, Adil, there are so many things you say sometimes are very good and they come as dismal failures. And some of them you say are so bad and they become big successes. Mm-hmm. So yes, so at least he had the temerity and he treated everyone at par. And there were no favorites with him. I think Jagdish Khattar opened a lot of cobwebs, blew a lot of cobwebs off in the minds of his own people. He empowered them. A lot of things. Plus, a lot of these new age Japanese guys who came in India understood that. They also, what you call, really enjoyed that sort of a tenor year and all that. And I think it only helped the company to really bloom further and further, you know.
And Maruti Suzuki, they blooded a whole lot of excellent executives in the car industry. Right from the start, all the people who the new manufacturers that were coming to India, they poached from
Correct.
Maruti, right?
What Maruti did with Telco, the wheel turned full circle. Now everyone, suddenly Maruti became a font for talent.
Mm.
And that is exactly what happened.
How did that happen?
Why
was Maruti the talent school for the Indian automotive industry?
Not just talent school, because they had the first mover advantage. They had done all the things right. Mm. Not just what we... They had cracked the code on, okay, if it ain't broke, fix it. Mm. They did that. They shattered a lot of myths. They went out and, most important thing, how you're welcomed into the dealership was an eye-opener for many. Mm. How you got your car serviced was an eye-opener for many. So that was not lost. What was tragic was the other companies, they took the people, but they were not willing to incorporate every and anything which the executives had learned from Maruti. Mm-hmm. So you saw, look at Mitsubishi, great car, great company, but that same ambassador mindset put the brakes on so many things. Mm-hmm. So Maruti was one, you put it in gear and you let it go. Mm. And that was it.
And what people don't really give Maruti enough credit for is even today, their cars, in terms of the reliability and the longevity, in terms of the sheer quality that nothing goes wrong, their cars are still superior to almost the entire competition.
Absolutely.
Look at the remotest parts of the country. There, it's either the Alto or the Gypsy that does duty. Nothing else. And the reason for that is the Alto goes everywhere, doesn't break down, and the Gypsy is the unbeatable, right?
The key thing is simplicity of the product. Everyone has forgotten that the more complex you make a car, and you can see it in the German manufacturers, Prestige guys, everything. But Prestige doesn't mean me sending my chauffeur with the car to the dealership every month to get... You never go to the Maruti dealership to get your cars
repaired.
Give it for service. That's fundamental to why these cars last long.
Yeah. But there's one area that Maruti hasn't really been listening to customers, and it's on the safety front, right? The reason why the 800, the original 800, was finally stopped was because it couldn't meet the future safety norms. The engine obviously could meet the emission norms, and it's still running, right?
Yes, yes.
But the final nail in the coffin was the safety norms? Or am I mistaken?
No, yes. Of course. See, in a maturing society, in a maturing market, in a much more opener world we live in, once you plant the seed of safety or any aspect inside that thing, pollution or green, how green you are or otherwise, people have to listen. And the world is evolving. Crash test, safety testing, etc. Maruti said the thing was, in India, our average speeds are not high. Mm. So what package we give works well. So I can accept that. But when you are going across, even at a slow speed, at a 40 kilometer per hour crash, you have found people. So the thing is that it's like how it's a politician's game here. This Maruti says, first get everyone to belt up, then we'll talk about safety. Because without that belting up, that crash. So I don't think a manufacturer has to, what you call, say, first you belt up, then we'll think about. It has to give you a product, whether you're belted up or not. You have to do that. So I think that tug of war was quite evident. It was like, I'll give you a small other example about how important costs are to, when the Bharat Stage 2 or Bharat Stage 3 things were given, we had a small nozzle near the fuel filler tank for the fumes to go back. There was a big UN cry from Maruti saying, no, we will not do it. They said in the SIM, he says, it would cost about 10 rupees per unit. And any Maruti owner in that overall scheme of 10. But the rationale from Maruti was, you guys make 20,000 cars in a year. We make 250,000 cars in. So you multiply 10 rupees by that and that would impact their thing. But that was Maruti not behaving like a leader. I've said that many a time. Maruti doesn't behave like a leader of the mind. It is a volume-driven company. But it, the day Maruti would start behaving like a leader there in the mind, it's showing some traces right now, but it needs to still evolve there.
So we talked about the Zen, then the Alto. Then the next evolution of this whole Alto generation, the platform, was the A-Star. The A-Star is that one model that really did not click in India.
Quirky design. At that time, you saw also the Daewoo Mattis which came in. But by the same year, you also had the Hyundai Santro and it clicked. So you never can sell. But I think again, Maruti priced it also pretty strongly, steeply. So that also could have been one. And it came very close to a bigger car, the price points, you know.
So that was that one generation that didn't click. But then obviously that evolved into the Celerio, the Hardtech platform, the Espresso, which is still doing the numbers for Maruti. But end of the day, the Alto still stays.
Alto is the cornerstone of everything that is Maruti.
We recently did a story. We took the Alto to Ladakh.
Yes.
We did the 8 passes in 24 hours. My first motorsport event was with an 800 Alto, where we won the reliability trail overall ahead of the 4x4s and SUVs. So ever since the Alto was launched, it has been the mountain goat.
It's a trendsetter. It has been the... It is a beacon for the Indian automotive industry, literally.
Would it be in, say, the top 5 Indian cars of all time? Where would the Alto be? Or in the top 10?
The top.
The number one.
Number one. It has to be that. You can say anything else. You can have your, get your horns out against Maruti on so many fronts. But you can never do it where the Alto is concerned.
And that has now led to the original 800s, especially the SS80s, actually going up in value.
I have one, I know that. But one thing I must tell you, don't ever go with your Maruti SS80 to a Maruti dealership to get it restored. They don't know how to do it. I had given it to one dealer here, and I ended up spending 4 days in a week with him over 6 months, trying to, make him... First and foremost, they don't understand carburetors. They, as soon as a carbureted Maruti comes in, they put their hands up. While I was making the car at that time, Maruti had just bought the first car which they had sold to that Sardarji in Delhi, Harpal Singh. So I had asked them, I need a door lock set for the car, because on the original 800, you have this ignition system. The ignition key, the doors, the fuel cap, fuel lid, and the tailgate. And if you have to replace the ignition switch, everything goes for a toss. So I said, can you give me one combined set? They could not find it. So they said, why are you asking? I said, I'm restoring. I said, please help us. So I helped them also with that thing, and I put them in touch with Tutu Dhawan to get their 800 done. So that thing, please don't go to Maruti dealerships to get your SS80s restored. After that, I had the car for 2 years. I was not. Then I gave it to Irfan Mughal in the Supercar Club garage in Bombay. And he already owns 2 800s, SS80s and all that. So he knew of. And they restored the car in the way the car needs. And now she's running absolutely like the way it...
So, in the modern perspective and the modern sense of how we relate to cars, what is it like driving an SS80?
right now, because given that I would not like to go. Means there's an art to getting inside the car and outside. Like how you would get into a Lamborghini, open the door, you get your butt in first and then get your feet inside. So you have to reevaluate your entire sense of purpose when you get behind the wheel. But once behind the wheel, the lightness of action, of touch, action, etc., the fluidity of the shift, the clutch, etc., is superb.
And the mechanical nature of the car?
Superb. It is so light, hardly about 750 kilograms. And the way she moves and darts in and out of, it gives the rickshawwalas a run for their money. Not that I would like to, what you call, spar with them. But yes, so it's so, what you call, highly maneuverable. Now, given the scarcity of these cars on our roads, it is definitely an Indian automotive icon. There's no two ways about it. And getting parts for this car is now becoming more and more and more difficult.
Do you think Maruti should also recognize its history and heritage? Maybe have a center where all the versions of their cars are all
Shirish,
on display.
I had spoken about this to one marketing chief of Maruti just about 3-4 years back. You know, he asked, what he told me, "Hamare paas paisa nahi hai ko ki lagane ke liye." Where it comes from, I'll tell you where it comes. It comes from his future promotions are determined directly with that sort of a perspective, because he has no clue about heritage or history. You need people who have got that bent of mind to take that and do it. So, and this is, at least he was forthright enough to say that. There are other companies also which have got tremendous history. They are trying in a small way to do that, but you need to have people with a bent of mind for heritage. They know their company, they know their products, they know everything, and then you make that thing. That car which happened because directly or indirectly, I had asked them for some parts for my car, and then they got talking and we put them in touch with Tutu, and Tutu being such a guy who has restored cars in that, so he knew what it needs to get an old car back in the right manner. Does, like I told you, no Maruti dealer should go with your old car.
In fact, Maruti's entire heritage, all the models that they've had, they are a reflection of the Indian automotive industry.
Absolutely.
They are a marker of the different steps and evolutions of
I only want to, I ask them, why is Suzuki having a collection in Japan and why are you not having that? No answer.
Yeah.
At that time, they say, "Oh, we'll talk about it."
So, in the final analysis, you said the Alto has been the most important car in the country, the game changer.
Yes.
What is that one thing that you want to say and want to highlight about how the Alto transformed India?
Everywhere, because it gave, most important thing what it did was it hastened the end of the dinosaurs, which we had got. And that was bound to happen. So it's just, but the key thing is that it brought the Indian automotive industry to take a big step up. The key thing what happened was, which could have happened was, or I don't know, because that is for a perspective to whether it, at least the government helped Maruti Udyog to establish that. And then the fallout from that helped trickle down to others as well. If it had opened everyone else, the scenario could have been different. Maruti might not have, what you call, been there. But so, like they say, everything, whatever happens, happens for the best. So in that sort of thing, the Maruti Udyog exercise with Suzuki Motor Corporation, led by the Alto, was really the thing which India needed then. And if you, even as you go forward from here, the role which that car played can never be denied. And that is really speaking, whatever we do now has trickled down from that car.
Awesome, Adil. Thank you for speaking to us on the Evo India podcast. I want to ask you before... Okay, you...
No, I just say, if Maruti Udyog decides to sue you, please let me be your lawyer.
But the Alto, the most important car in the country. What is the second most important car in the country?
The next Alto.
Okay.
The Zen.
Okay, so no, after all the Marutis, the reason I'm asking is that the next one, we'll do it. Would you say the Indica was the second most important car in India?
I'll leave it with you one thing. We were at Overdrive magazine. We knew about the Indica. And I remember it was a Friday or a Thursday. And at Bombay Gymkhana, the Indica was going to be unveiled. And they was going to talk about the price point. This was going to be in the evening at about 6:30. At 12:30, we get press releases from Maruti saying that dropped prices for the Zen, the STM and whatnot. Very critically, the Indica represented a challenger, a homegrown challenger. So yes, the Indica definitely.
So second most important car in India, the Tata Indica, and that will be the subject of our next podcast. So these podcasts are an extension of the Gone But Not Forgotten series, which is there in Evo India magazine, also on the Evo India YouTube channel. So we're going to take this to the podcast room, talk in further detail about the Indica on the next podcast. So thank you guys for listening and watching. If you have any comments on the Alto's journey, on your experiences, your memories of the Alto, drop it in the comments. We'd love to listen to them. Adil is here. He'll reply to all those comments. And the next one is on the Indica. So if you have any questions on the Indica, drop that also in the comments and we'll take it up on our next podcast. Thank you, Adil.
Thanks, Shirish.
And thank you guys for listening and watching. If you enjoy this also, give us a thumbs up and share it with like-minded enthusiasts.